Every story told has a story of its own, getting you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now, here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, a show re-examining the biggest news stories of the week, as well as those that need a deeper dive as told by the reporters out in the field. I'm your host, Adam Roberts. Thanks again for joining me today. We've got a lot of ground to cover once again this week, and I'm going to start by examining a little bit closer the sometimes tenuous exchanges that can occur between local leaders in government bodies and members of the media. Specifically this week, we're examining a recent incident at a St. Francis school board meeting. This took place between Superintendent of the District Deborah Kerr and a reporter from TMJ4 Megan Lee, as well as her photographer Dan Seelan. The pair were at a board meeting preparing to film the public comment portion of that meeting, seeking parents talking about former junior varsity baseball coach Jeff Wuerl, who the district says was removed from his position after he was arrested by the Milwaukee Police Department. Outside the meeting in a common area, Lee is working on a laptop when she is approached by Superintendent Kerr.
Okay. You are not allowed to come to our meetings because you did not give us any notice or tell us why you were here. I just talked to my attorney, Rob Bukema, and we are happy to give you any public comment that we get today. It's an open board meeting, like you said. It's open board meeting, but you're not filming.
So we're gonna, see your...
I'm going to ask you to leave now, and if you don't leave, I've already told you, I will call the police.
That clip is just a portion of the exchange between the pair that has now led to a legal dispute between the two sides. President and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project and TMJ4 attorney Tom Kamenick has filed a verified open meetings law complaint against the district, claiming Kerr's actions violate Wisconsin open meetings laws. I am joined by TMJ4 reporter Megan Lee, as well as the photojournalist with her that day, Dan Seelan. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So let's begin by, Megan, if I'll have you walk through those moments that happened off camera, because when Dan started rolling, it captures only half of the story. There was an interaction you had with the superintendent before the camera started to roll.
Yes. So we got to the school, St. Francis High School, just like any other school board meeting. We usually get a little bit of B-roll outside just for our story later that night. So Dan shot some B-roll, and then we got into St. Francis. We were let in by actually a school board member because the door was locked because they were starting in closed session.
And that's an important part to mention as well, because the meeting itself, the public portion, happened, I believe, at 6:30, but there was a closed session portion that began before that.
Yes. Yeah. So, and usually you don't see that. Usually closed session is afterwards.
Right.
So that was already a little interesting to me that they were starting in closed session. So we got in. It was around probably 5:45-ish. We're sitting in the vestibule area in the high school downstairs, and the meetings happen upstairs in the library. We were sitting there for a few minutes, and then here comes Superintendent Deborah Kerr. She approaches us pretty hot, I would say. It was a very, like she really came at us, basically was asking us why we were there. And she said that we couldn't film in the public meeting. And I said, no, we're here to film during the public comment. I'm here because of the investigation I've been looking into. And she said the words, I won't forget it. What more do you want from me? I gave you a statement last week. And then she looked at us and said she was going to go call her attorneys. And I said, okay, we'll do the same. So
Dan, that's when the rolling began, because you had an interaction, I believe, with Megan during that middle period.
Yes, superintendent had walked away at that point to call her attorney, and Megan kind of looked at me like, "What the heck's going on here?" And I said, "I've never seen this before." But and then Megan said, "We'll make sure that we're rolling when she comes back." So that's exactly. I set the camera in a good spot to make sure I got both parties involved speaking to make sure there was clear what was going to happen. And I think the video speaks for itself what happened when the superintendent came back.
And then there was a conversation, Megan, that you had with your managing editor while this also gap in time was happening. What was discussed and what guidance were you given?
Yeah. Anytime there's an issue when we're out in the field, I typically call our managers just to make sure they know what's going on. So I called our managing editor and I just said, hey, this is what's happening. And actually, they were all in the same room, all of our managers. And they're like, Megan, you have every right to be there. You and Dan are allowed to be there. You can film. They were actually trying to pull up the policy from the school district to see if there was some weird language about having to give prior notice that we were going, but they kept reiterating, you can be there. It's an open meeting laws in Wisconsin. Like, it was just very like, you can be there.
And that language in particular you mentioned, Megan, per the policy 0167.3, there's a sentence in here that your lawyer keyed in on. It says the person operating the equipment should contact the superintendent prior to the board meeting to review possible placement of the equipment. Dan, as someone who handles this stuff, have you ever been told before going to any meeting, you must contact us or should, as the wordage is here, contact to set up equipment?
Prior to a meeting, no. We've showed up at meetings and they've said, you know, we need the meeting to set up in this location. So we're not impeding in the meeting whatsoever. We're not obstructing anyone else participating in the meeting. But never have I had to give notice that we were coming to a meeting.
I think the key word, Adam, is should. We don't know when we're covering stories sometimes. Like, sometimes it's a last-minute thing that we're going mm-hmm. to a meeting. And if we had to contact a superintendent every time we went to a meeting, I mean, they would be filled with requests from other stations, too. Like, let's say Milwaukee Public Schools had that in their bylaws. They would be just flooded with people requesting to come. The keyword is should. It's not must. But Deborah Kerr sent me an email that evening and said, I must get her approval, or I must send her a notice that we're coming. And no, that's not it. It should.
We're talking with TMJ4 reporter Megan Lee and photojournalist Dan Seelan about their exchange with superintendent of the St. Francis School District, Deborah Kerr, and the subsequent lawsuit. We'll come back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ. Welcome back to Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ. Continuing our conversation now with TMJ4 reporter Megan Lee and photojournalist Dan Seelan on an incident that occurred June 2nd at St. Francis's school board meeting between the pair and Superintendent Deborah Kerr over open meetings law. Now, Dan, you've been in this industry for about as long as anyone in the Milwaukee market, working largely behind the scenes as a photojournalist, but you've had a lot of roles and worn a lot of hats over the years. In your time working in this capacity, how frequent would you say, not just superintendents necessarily, but public officials and governmental bodies in general, is there an underlying tone of frustration, exasperation maybe?
It comes up occasionally. I wouldn't say that often. That's why this kind of took me back a little bit. I've been a photojournalist for, say, 20 years here in Milwaukee, and occasionally, it kind of depends on the story, what kind of gets everyone kind of riled up. And, you know, sometimes when they're there for something separate, per se, for some of these appearances or press conferences, they'll be a little like, well, why are you here? I'm not here to talk about that. I'm not going to delve into that. And, you know, I'm going to stay way off of that topic. But you kind of, in some cases, you know, if it's a major issue and we need to get to the facts, then we'll press the issue a little bit. But in this case, and you know, when it comes to meetings, we're very respectful. We're very quiet. I've been to dozens of different districts all over Southeast Wisconsin, and we've never been a problem. I don't feel we've never been a distraction in the meetings. I'm very quiet when we're moving the gear or setting things up. We're there just to observe and to see what the issue was or what the issue is. And a lot of times we're asked to come to these meetings by the public to observe and to see what's happening and to investigate the issues that they're having in that particular district. It kind of depends on the issue that kind of has the person riled up and on guard when they see the media coming.
And Megan, you mentioned that when you were at the school in the lobby area, you were trying to find the bylaw for the district and the service was pretty crummy within that building. Do you sometimes, if you know you're going to an area where there have been issues, large or small in the past, whether it's at this job or others, do you sometimes keep copies of specific rules, whether it's written or otherwise, just so you can reference that in case something comes up?
You know, that's a good question. For going forward, I probably will. This is a definite, this is a learning lesson, I hope, on all parties. I will most likely have those bylaws in my back pocket if I go to a new district. Milwaukee Public Schools, we go to those meetings all the time.
Sure.
And they even have like a media area for us. So I've never really thought about bringing those. I think in my back pocket, like, I always know that we are allowed in open session meetings and we are allowed to film according to the law. So I always remember that. And I'm glad I knew that and I was confident in that when we had the encounter with Deborah Kerr. But going forward, I will be having those bylaws in my back pocket.
I wanted to read a statement that TMJ4 included as part of their coverage of this story from last week Thursday, where Deborah Kerr issued a response to the St. Francis community on the issue. And the quote is, "I apologize for the way the situation was handled. In hindsight, I wish I had approached it differently, and I regret any frustration or uncertainty this may have caused." Has Superintendent Kerr reached out to whether it's either of you two or Channel 4 specifically since this matter?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge as well either.
And yeah. So the litigation as of right now is still pending in that open records law complaint.
Yes, it is. The Corporation Counsel did acknowledge that they are looking into it with our attorney, Tom Kamenek. And yeah, so he kind of sent us an email last week and just said that they acknowledged that they got it. And we're just kind of waiting to see. There's like a 20-day period that they could move forward with it, or then we would have to take it into our own hands.
Per transparency for today's episode, we have reached out to both Superintendent Kerr and the school district attorney, Rob Bukema, for comment on the matter. We at this point have not heard back. TMJ4 reporter Megan Lee and photojournalist Dan Seelan joining me today on Reporter's Notebook. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ.
We want peace to come to our city. The peace that we need to have happen needs to begin in Washington, and we need to stop the race.
That's the mayor of Los Angeles, Karen Bass, speaking on Thursday regarding the ongoing anti-ICE protests that have been going on in her city since last weekend and have continued since. In the span of the week, President Trump has sent thousands of National Guard soldiers and members of the Marine Corps to the city to quell the protests. The city, meanwhile, for their part, has installed a curfew most nights for the downtown area. And now those protests have gone from Los Angeles, spreading throughout the rest of the country, mainly in bigger cities across the U.S. That includes here in Milwaukee as well, where an anti-ICE protest marched through the streets of downtown on Tuesday. WTMJ's Elizabeth Linton was among the crowd covering the protest for us. And Liz, you followed this from its beginnings in downtown all the way to their march at the Homeland Security office on Knapp Street. This is among the Milwaukee School of Engineering campus in that area as you head towards Water Street. What were you seeing? What were you hearing from those that were gathered?
Yeah, so the protest started out in Cathedral Square. There were signs gathering. There were signs being handed out. There was a protester who's been hand-painting signs. He's a retired artist, and he's been hand-painting signs for years, and so he was passing those out. And the crowd gathered there, and there were a couple speakers at Cathedral Square by the stage. And then as the march began, it headed down Wells Street towards Water. What I noticed most distinctly was that as I took a step back, as the protest continued marching, more and more people were joining. So in the Cathedral Square, I would have said maybe a couple hundred people. But by the time that we were all down on Water Street, it looked to be about 2,000 people. It quickly grew.
And the images that we saw did show that kind of long line stretching back down the street as it was heading towards the north. Largely a peaceful demonstration, you would say?
I would say it was an entirely peaceful demonstration, really. I don't think that there were any... there were no violent, riotous moments at any point.
Was law enforcement, did they have a presence along the route?
I saw maybe one or two sheriff's vehicles, one or two police vehicles, but they seemed to mostly be focused on like blocking off the streets as opposed to getting involved with the protesters in any way. I also saw a couple overhead police drones just probably to keep an eye on things. But overall, there was not a huge police presence. I was actually kind of surprised by that. I didn't really know what to expect going into this reporting. And I saw, again, police helping block off the streets as the protesters moved throughout their loop in downtown. But other than that, I did not see very many police officers.
WTMJ's Elizabeth Littinen covering the ICE protest in downtown Milwaukee earlier this week. Liz, thank you very much.
Yeah, anytime.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ.
As we look ahead to some of the events we're going to be following this coming week here on the station, you may hear us talk a little bit about an event happening in Stevens Point. If you're familiar with the golf course Century World, and for those in the golf world, how could you not? The flowers, they speak for themselves, but we do have an event coming up at Century World this week, the Rolex Girls Junior Championship. Some of the best young lady golfers from all across the country are going to be right here in Wisconsin. And that includes a 16-year-old from right here in our area, Beaver Dam. Her name's McKenna Nelson. And we had a chance to talk with her earlier on Wisconsin's Morning News. And by we, I mean WTMJ's Vince Vetrano, who is with me now. And Vince, for a little bit of background, what should people know about this young golfer that if they don't know already, they should?
Well, first of all, whenever I talk about golf, Adam, and you know I love golf, but I know everybody doesn't.
Sure.
So for me, golf stories that we bring to our listeners here on WTMJ always have to be about a little bit more than golf, right? Mm-hmm. And McKenna's story is fantastic. She's an amazing golfer. I don't want to put too much pressure on her, but certainly she is on track to be an elite golfer in college and perhaps have a shot at being a golfer for a living. And she's just 16 years old. She is our WIAA defending state champion. She won the state championship in fall, which is when girls golf is in high school. She shot a 65 at University Ridge on the first of 2 days.
For context, I believe my first day back in 2012 when I was at the state tournament, I am pretty sure I almost shot triple digits.
Right.
So that puts this into some context.
Yes. So she's real good at golf. And she is joining this field that's going to be 72 girls golfers, ages 12 to 19. And there's actually an international component to it as well. These are the top 72 or among the top 72 golfers on the planet in that age group for girls in golf. So a really elite field, and McKenna is going to be among them. Excited about the chance to play in her own backyard.
Now, you as a anchor, host, reporter, you wear a lot of hats at WTMJ. But part of your job and all of ours is to conduct interviews, and we're always looking for those juicy nuggets, those sound bites that you hear on the station all the time. But when you interview young people in particular, sometimes it's a challenge kind of navigating, and you want to give them the space to be themselves, but we also have a job to do as reporters and hosts of a show. How have you, over the years, when you're interviewing younger people, teens, maybe young adults, what strategies do you like to use to try and bring out the best in an interview from them?
Well, it's kind of hard, too, if you're not. I was in TV, we were so often in person. We're together in that shared space, and then you have different cues and things that you can look for in terms of that engagement. If you're virtual, as we were, so I could see her because we were over Zoom, but you know, you're not together, so that is a little bit of a challenge. You know, for me, it's always, and I'm a dad now, and my twins are just graduated from high school this past weekend, so I know in that space when you communicate with young people, you just got to meet them where they are and be yourself. You don't try to be reporter guy. Don't try to be journalist guy. Don't try to be interview guy. You just be yourself and ask the questions that are interesting to you, also channeling what you think would be interesting to other people.
Now, that said, you have had quite a career in both radio and television. Is there a moment that stands out to you where maybe the total opposite happened and you found yourself just trying, just come on, kid, give me something here. I got to go back to the boss.
Almost deliberately, and that was sort of the point. I remember we did this Thanksgiving story, and it was one of those, and it's hardly a unique idea, but it's funny every time we went to like a second grade classroom in Wauwatosa where I grew up. We were at Washington Elementary, and we're asking kids how to prepare various things for Thanksgiving. And the whole joke of it was I don't know, bake it at 25 degrees for like 10 minutes. And like, so the point of it was to get to those moments where they didn't really know what to say.
Before I let you go, Vince, you mentioned that you have high school graduations that happened this past weekend for you. As you've gone through this journey of being a father, how has your experience through parenthood framed the way you conduct yourself on air, whether through interviews with children or otherwise?
I think once you become a parent, you connect with other parents in a different way. And like, for example, when there's a tragedy that involves a child, we have this, you know, story out of the Pewaukee native who's accused of killing his own children. Every parent, and you know this instantly when you become one, whenever you have a tragedy that involves a child, you immediately put your children's faces on those victims' faces. You feel what it would be like in your heart, in your mind, in your home to experience that level of tragedy. So it deeply personalizes in some ways so many other stories. It's so much easier to empathize with people and understand. So I would say I just grew as a person that way through parenthood. I will also say, as my kids have graduated, I feel like I'm graduating too. I'm very excited and proud of myself.
Yeah, you did a great
job. That's right. I think I did a great
round
job,
of applause,
Adam.
For right. WTMJ's Vince Vitrano with me on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks, Vince.
You bet, bud.
You're listening to Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ.
Welcome back to Reporter's Notebook. Hope you're having a wonderful day today. When we talk about Wisconsin and waterways, I can't think of too many that are more mighty than the mighty Mississippi River, making up much of our state's western border, which we share with Iowa in portions. And in that area of the southwest part of the state, there's been an ongoing back and forth over a bridge that connects the area near DeSoto, Wisconsin, to Lansing, Iowa. And the on-again-off-again nature of the Black Hawk Bridge specifically has real-life impacts on the community. And to dig in a little bit more with this, I'm joined by health and environmental reporter Madeline Heim from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who has been covering the Mississippi River area for several years now. And Madeline, let's start first with the background. If people have never traversed the Black Hawk Bridge, let's dive in a little bit to what bridge specifically we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate being able to be here. This is a really iconic bridge over the Mississippi River. As you said, it connects Lansing, which is a city in northeast Iowa, to DeSoto in Crawford County, Wisconsin. The official name, as you mentioned, is the Black Hawk Bridge, but you'll hear it referred to a lot casually just as the Lansing Bridge. And it was built back in 1931, and it's really kind of a symbol for the surrounding region. One of the most interesting things about it is it's known as a singing bridge because of the metal grate flooring that is at the base of it, and it makes kind of a humming sound when cars drive across it. I've driven across it many times, and it's really, really unique. The other thing to point out is it's a very important bridge. It's the only way to cross the river between La Crosse and Prairie du Chien, which is about 60 miles between those two places. And the towns on either side of the Lansing Bridge are very linked. So, you know, when it closes, when it's not available to be crossed, a journey to the grocery store or to your doctor's appointment that might have taken you 10 minutes could turn into a 100-plus-mile commute if you have to turn around and go to the bridge in Prairie du Chien, for example.
So as we've detailed, this bridge obviously is a very important link between the communities, and at least on one side of the river, it appears as though someone who runs a ferry operation has at least taken the initiative to say, well, if the bridge is going to be closed for any period of time, I might as well offer the community a service that it clearly needs, because as you mentioned, Madeline, that drive, if you're not going to be able to just go over the bridge, is a really long commute.
Yeah. So this happened during the last closure last year as well, that Iowa DOT contracted with Maiden Voyage Tours, which is out of Marquette, Iowa, to run a free to the people that use it ferry service across the river. It's about a 4-minute boat ride across the river. And then there's a shuttle on either side to get you to a specific drop off point, either in Lansing or in DeSoto. And I've heard that even though the bridge is reopened, you know, Maiden Voyage Tours has that contract. And so they're going to continue doing that. But another interesting thing, I think, is, you know, these are river communities. A lot of people have boats. And so I heard a lot while the bridge was closed that people were taking the initiative to just, you know, take themselves and their coworkers across the river in their personal boat, dock it, and, you know, get to where they needed to be. Again, these communities are so linked, and there are lots of people who live on one side and work on the other.
So when we talk about the community of Lansing, Iowa, it's not a large community, about 1,000 people per the 2020 census, but that represents an economic pool for businesses even on the Wisconsin side of the river. What are we seeing in terms of whether it's numbers or just general feelings on how businesses are handling this construction period?
That was what I was most interested in when I heard that the bridge was closed again. Is, you know, talking to businesses on both sides of the river about what they noticed. And it was really eye-opening. I spoke with Lori Jansen, who she owns Lansing Hardware Hank, a longtime hardware store in Lansing, along with her husband. And she said about half their consumers come from Wisconsin, and she can tell immediately when the bridge is open or closed based on foot traffic, which I thought was just incredible. Like you said, you know, these are tourist areas. Summer is really, really important to them. So if people decide to give up, you know, not come, that could mean the difference between a business surviving or closing. And, you know, one thing I found when reporting this story that I thought was really interesting is we've got a historical example to look back to. The bridge crossing the river at Prairie du Chien had to close in the early 1980s. And I was speaking with a dentist from Lansing about this current closure. And he said he knew one of the dentists downriver in Iowa when that bridge was closed. And he said, you know, that dentist practice never recovered from having that closure.
We're talking with Madeline Heim, health and environmental reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. As we now look into the future, whether it's this bridge or others across the state of Wisconsin, do we know how the Department of Transportation weighs which bridges need priority, whether it's for construction or renovation or demolition? Because a lot of times people will raise their hand and say, hey, my community's bridge needs a fix, and it's needed a fix forever. But when that list gets too long, it can be hard to put one particular bridge at the top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't know a lot about the specifics of how those get picked, especially in different places, but I will say, you know, why this bridge in particular was given priority for replacement. It's very old. And then interestingly, this bridge crosses over one of the very tightest turns on the entire Mississippi River. And with the current bridge supports, it's hard for barges to make that turn. And there have actually been collisions in the past with barges and the bridge. And so the new bridge will widen that distance between those supports so that it's a little easier for barges to clear. So again, you know, it's not exactly my area of expertise how these projects get picked. But again, just going back to this specific bridge, this is something where politics is just really not part of it for these communities. They need a reliable bridge. They need a reliable way to cross the river. It's a reminder that there are things bigger than, you know, who's in the White House when it comes to how people are able to navigate their daily lives.
Madeline Heim is a health and environmental reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been covering the Mississippi River region for a long time. And this story, it's close to home for many in that part of our state. Madeline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ.
Welcome back. It's Reporter's Notebook on WTMJ, wrapping up a Sunday show with a stuffed emu conversation. It was first seen in the American Family Field stands earlier this month. A lady captured on the FanDuel Sports Network broadcast walking around the seats in the outfield at the Brewers game with a stuffed emu of all things.
That is what looks to be an ostrich?
An emu?
All right. That's a first. I don't think I've ever seen an emu at the ballpark.
There's the audio, and as you can clearly tell, there were some puzzled ponderings from the broadcast crew, and so we welcome in Brewers broadcaster Jeff Levering with us on Reporter's Notebook. And Jeff, we'll get to the emu coverage here in a moment, but you've certainly seen your share of interesting sights as you've come up through broadcasting over the years, whether it's in the minors or in the big leagues.
Where does a stuffed emu rank in terms of the oddest things you've seen in the stands, not necessarily on the field?
Yeah, in the stands, it's up there. You wonder, because they put such limitations on the size of the bag that you can bring into the ballpark, and it's got to be clear and XYZ, how one could sneak an emu in or get the emu a ticket in the first place, right? So now I have a lot of questions. Does the emu have a ticket, or did it just come as a guest with the seat and as a lap child, right? So I have a lot of questions, but I was very thrilled to hear that the emu made it in, and we had some fun with it on the air. There's no doubt. It is up there in my oddest things that I've seen in the stands.
Yeah, we did confirm when talking with Brittany from Watertown that she says she bought a ticket for it. And if you're the security guy and you see, hey, he's ticketed, he can get in, and there's nothing nefarious inside, it's like, well, all right, one time only, go have fun.
Right. Yeah. As long as there's a ticket and it's paid for, I think that they're going to be just fine with that. I will say that one of the oddest things that I've seen, and that the emu was one, and you brought it in, you had the ticket, but the one that I always go back to in terms of animals and oddities in a ballpark would have been one of my first years of professional baseball. I was in Rancho Cucamonga, and we were playing in a game in San Jose against the Giants, an A-ball affiliate of the San Francisco Giants. And they brought a group of policemen on horseback onto the field in the outfield. And these horses, there was three huge horses, were in center field. And along with these horses were three people with massive shovels behind these horses.
Oh no!
Just in case. And the center fielder is right next to these horses in the middle of the national anthem. And lo and behold, those big old shovels were used. And there was some horse droppings in center field that night in San Jose, California.
Not the weirdest thing I've seen in center field in the ball game. I always think of Disco Demolition Night, when there was literally a crater in the hole of Old Comiskey.
Always, yeah. And whenever there's an adopted dog or something like that, or you know, the Humane Society brings their dogs into the ballpark and they let one, and one gets loose, inevitably something wrong is going to happen, right? And I've seen that at second base. I've seen it on the infield dirt. I mean, it happens. They're just animals. Bound to happen.
We're talking with Brewers broadcaster Jeff Levering on Reporter's Notebook. Jeff, I'm curious, as someone who has to keep track of so many things, I mean, baseball is a sport of so many moving parts and so many statistics. What is your strategy you found over the years works best for keeping track of all the various goings on during a ball game beyond what you're seeing just on the field too?
Oh man, I mean, I just try and keep my head on a swivel, right? And it's almost a survive in advance. First of all, I'm just making sure I get the plays right, you know, hits and errors and all the other things. And there's so many other things that you have to keep track of during a baseball game, pitch counts and whatever else. So as long as I can keep my head above the water in terms of those things, I think I'm fine. But I'm always looking out at the field. I'm always cognizant of what's happening around me in the crowd, and if there's something going on in the stands or whatever's happening. It's not like I'm living in the stands, but I like to have a beat of what's going on, and that's an important thing. And if I can catch something like our great camera crew did on the TV side with the emu, then that's great, and we could talk about it. I love watching kids eat ice cream, because it's going to go all over their faces at some point, or all the cool costumes that people are coming up with the other day. There was a group of five people that dressed exactly like the racing sausages in the ball game yesterday. So I'm all about it. I'm all about seeing all the fun stuff and just trying to keep my head on a swivel so I don't miss anything, because you never know what you're going to see when you show up at a ball game.
Speaks to the importance of having a good producer on your squad as well that can get in your ear and say, hey, I just saw in section 404, someone dropped a whole pizza onto someone in the seat below or whatever.
Yeah, that's a Kent Sommerfeld special. I mean, we got to get him off the phone every now and again, but once we get him off the phone, he's doing a great job and he's in the stands. He's letting us know what's going on. And I mean, that goes back to a great clip from the Red Sox. This would have been about 15 years ago. It was an April game, and there's a play down the left field line. You got left fielder and right and a third baseman that are going for this ball, and they're going into the stands, and it ends up a couple of rows back. And I think it was a Red Sox Yankees game, and one of the Red Sox fans threw a piece of pizza at one of the players, and you just hear the announcer, it's Jerry Remy, goes, "Ah, here comes the pizza." And it's not even pizza, it's pizza, just because of the way that the New England accent is.
Now watch. I can't circle. I don't have my telestrator today, but here comes a pizza. See it? Oh, jeez.
Highly unnecessary.
You just never know what you're going to see. Throw pizza. You can get an emu. You can get all kinds of things. I'm still in the camp of, at some point during my career, I haven't done it yet, minors or big leagues, that when the cotton candy person walks by, or the person who's walking by with the big like hourglass shaped drinks, one of these days I'm gonna lean over and just grab one. I haven't done that from the booth yet, but I would like to try that at some point, just to see if I could pull off. I'll pay for it later, but I just want to see if I can take my claw and grab one.
Be hard to do at American Family Field because your booth is so much higher up than the walk down below, but you could give it a try if you want.
Yeah, I mean, I know if I do it in the radio booth, Lane will freak out, because anytime I get anywhere near some sort of height differential, he is very scared of height. So I'll make sure to lean out a little extra when Lane's in the booth with me.
Before I let you go, Jeff, the Brewers did fall to the Pirates the night Stuart the Emu made his appearance. Too early still to dub it the Curse of the Emu a la the Billy Goat?
No, no chance. No chance. It's way too early. It hasn't even been a week yet. So I think that it's fine. I will say that the homestand has not gone particularly well for the Brewers since the Emu showed up, but there's a lot of time to make up ground. I think it's time for a game two for Stewart.
Duly noted. Brewers broadcaster Jeff Levering with us on Reporter's Notebook. Thanks, Jeff.
You got it. Thank you.